Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This is the seventh talk in the series for the 2006 Rains Retreat, as we come very close to the middle of this three-month period. And many of you will find just the difference between how meditation sounds really easy, but sometimes how hard it is to do. That peace and tranquility, the theory, is very clear. But sometimes the practice is just hard. It's because each one of us is dealing with some tendencies which have been ingrained in us for many lifetimes. It's not easy to go against those tendencies, but basically we have no choice. Just the amount of suffering which is there in this life, which should always be reflected upon. Just the amount of pain, deaths, which happen from time to time. And never think that just because it hasn't come to you yet, it's never going to happen. As one chant we used to do as young monks in Thailand said, Jara domom hi jarang anati to. It started off that I am of the nature to age, I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to get sick, I have not gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die, I have not gone beyond death. And each one of those reflections just reminds us of our situation, so we don't become heedless. That we remember the situation which we're in, and we remember just our experiences of life so far. Just how we search for this happiness which is always elusive, just like chasing a rainbow. When we chase after it, it recedes from us. We get moments of happiness, promises which never actually provide what they say they should promise. And if happiness was a commodity sold in a shop, the shopkeeper would be prosecuted and put in jail by now for not satisfying the promises which happiness or worldly happiness carries along with it. And so many of us are here. The reason why we're here is the world outside is not satisfying. We've seen through it, and the very fact that you have come to a monastery means you have quite a large degree more wisdom than the ordinary folk. But still, we search for this peace, this happiness, and sometimes in our meditation it can get so frustrating, and sometimes we look to see monastic life, worldly life, what's the difference? Both make me frustrated. But you're here because there's some inkling there. There's some crack in the facade of samsara which lets you to see an alternative. That there is an alternative. That there is a way out of samsara. And this is why that you are here. And the message would always be, never give up. Keep opening up that crack as much as you can. Because that's all there is. Otherwise you just have to go round and round lifetime after a lifetime. This lifetime you're close. So don't give it up. But to be able to open that crack even further, so you can understand what the problem is and how it's dealt with, is actually to look at the problem of upadana. Again, upadana, it's terrible that sometimes these words have got translations attached to them. See, like upadana's got its attachment, which is the word attachment. But more and more that I read those suttas, the more and more that I practice, the more I find the word fuel, the gas, the supply of energy, the source of the momentum, the upadana, I find that is a far more effective way of understanding this word. Because the whole of Buddhism seems to be this cause and effect. You have an effect and you say, why? Where does it come from? The wise meditator doesn't just use willpower to overcome the problems. They use wisdom power. They investigate. And to investigate, you've got to find the cause. Why? Where did this come from? And the cause and effect mechanisms also has like the fuel system. That's why that in the suttas, that one of the most powerful fuels is the five hindrances, where the Buddha said it is the five hindrances which fuels delusion. And it's a powerful saying, because what it means, if you can accept that and embrace that, and have some insight into it, it means whenever there's five hindrances there, likes and dislikes, restlessness, sloth and torpor, just doubt, you will never see the truth. It will just feed the delusion more and more. And for most people, they try and escape from suffering just by giving those five hindrances more power. Just we search even more for sensory pleasures, or we just get into ill will and thinking that that negativity will be able to drag us through life or drag us through this day. You just see that so often, just how people become caught into this negativity, always putting this person down, that person down, putting this religion down, that philosophy down. And just the negativity just feeds delusion. But it gives you a sense of self, a sense of righteousness, when you drag everyone else down. Sometimes you feel a bit better about it. This isn't even a saying in this little book I've got next to my seat. You don't need to try and keep up with the Joneses. Just drag them down to your level. It's much easier. And other times that's what people try and do. Well, that's just feeding delusion. And of course that just keeps the problem of suffering going round and round and round and round. The same with restlessness, sloth and torpor, doubt. All these things are feeding delusion. These are upadana. It's a fuel source which keeps delusion going. And you can see just how it is a fuel, which is why that somehow or other that we have to find some means of calming, quelling, settling these five hindrances down. You got the sort of the fuel of like and dislike, especially the first fuel, karma chanda, of sensory desire. And you can look at just how much of our life we do concern with the five senses, with our body especially, try to give it comfortable. Sometimes we have gut ache. If we haven't got gut ache, we've got back ache. If we haven't got back ache, we've got hip ache, because we meditate a lot. There's always some ache in this body. And this is one of the problems with having a body. And the older you get, the worse it gets. The aches increase and increase and increase. So we have to find some way of dealing with this. And instead of actually just trying to run away from the problems of the body, by just trying to put in more happiness in there from the sensory world, and it becomes a never-ending project. That's why a lot of people get off into alcohol and drugs. Just an escape of trying to find a bit of pleasure. But they have to pay for it afterwards. And that's the problem. People who have been addicted to things like heroin. So they don't take heroin for a high anymore. They just take the heroin to remain feeling normal. Just the pleasure they got at the beginning, they're having to pay back right now. And heroin, or sexual fantasies, or whatever else you get into in your private moments, is exactly the same. It's just borrowing. And after a while you have to do those things just to feel normal. There has to be another way, and of course there is. It's actually understanding that, you know, these are the fueling of suffering, and you have to use some degree of restraint. A restraint is a right effort. Restraint is a not doing. A restraint is having the wisdom to see the way your mind is going and not giving it energy, not investing your interest in that, not furthering it. I know that many times that people have come to me in their interviews, especially on meditation retreats with lay people, and they say, well, I can't get my mind quiet, just thoughts come into my mind by themselves. It's true that the thought might come into the mind by itself, because of conditioning, cause and effect. But it continues, it finds a foothold in your mind because you favor it, because you allow it, because you say, come in, sit down, and you entertain it. In the same way a person will come into your house and they will stay there as long as you entertain it. As a senior monk, when I receive guests after the meal, I've become skilled in knowing how to get rid of them when I'm tired. And that's why you can actually see, those of you who upatthaka me, very, very, very rare do I stay down there longer than, say, 12:30, sometimes 10 past, or 5 past, or even today, 12 o'clock, I'm out of there. And how do you do that? Why is it that some other monks sometimes are there till 1 o'clock or 1:30? They don't know how to dismiss people. When you don't pay them interest, when you don't get involved, when you don't get sucked in there, they soon know it, and they just depart. And that's the same way you deal with the thoughts and fantasies and mind states which come up into your mind. When you don't entertain them, but you have this mind of dismissal. Yeah, you can come up, yeah, thank you very much for coming, very good, now go. Now if you can do that to the thoughts, the fantasies, the mind states which arise in your mind, you too will have more time for peace. Just like me, you can dismiss the lay community when they come after the meal. You can be kind to them, you can be civil, dismiss in the same way that when thoughts come in your mind, you can be kind to them, civil, and dismiss them. So you can have much more time of silence, much more time of freedom. The upadana, which is the fuel which stops you having the freedom, the fuel of being inside a prison, the fuel of the fetters, is you just get involved in these things. And this is one of the key words which I've been using over the last year with my meditation. Instead of using like detachment, which was a bit too negative for my mind anyway, I just got disengagement. And the word engagement, you know, has all these wonderful negative meanings of being engaged to another person and getting married to them, that gears engaging and grinding together. It means that there's two things which come together when they really shouldn't be. And disengaging is understands that you have got into these things, you have engaged with these things, but you know how to disengage. You know how to dismiss. You know how to separate. You know how to stop the upadana. And this is very important, to be able to know the fuel and know how to turn it off. To know what fuels thinking, to know what fuels moods. Sometimes, no matter who you are in this monastery, sometimes you get into negative moods. Sometimes you just wake up on the wrong side of your mat in the morning. We don't have beds, so you can't wake up on the wrong side of the bed, at least I don't. You wake up on the wrong side of the bed in the morning, or something happens and you're in a grumpy mood. That's nature, because you can see where it comes from. It could be that you've got sick, or you've got lots of burdens in your day to deal with. But you know the fuel source. You know how to cut it off. There's other times you're just very ebullient. You're just having a wonderful time and you're just full of fun and jumping up and down, but you know how to cut that off as well. You know the fuel source for your moods. That's why one of the strongest or most repetitive pieces of advice of Ajahn Chah when we were young monks was, don't follow your moods, don't get lost in them. You know they're just moods, they're not yours. They just come and go just like the clouds in the sky. Huge, but fast. So know your moods, but especially know what fuels them. And what happens usually if someone is in a really grumpy, negative mood? What fuels them is more negative thoughts. I don't want to do this. Why should I do this? This isn't right. This is not the real way a monastery should be run. This is... If anyone you ever thinks like that, one of these days we're going to start a hermitage and you can try and run a monastery. And it's just a difficult thing to run. It's a difficult thing to give talks. It's a difficult thing to give people instructions. Whatever it is, it's always a difficult thing. But you don't add more difficulty to it by negative thinking. Whatever you're experiencing, you just notice it. You're aware of it. And you don't add negativity to the negativity which you already have because of natural causes. You have to be careful. Otherwise, people who add negativity to negativity, that's what they call in Buddhism double dukkha. You've got pain in the stomach, you know, you're not very peaceful, and you get negative thoughts, and it becomes dukkha upon dukkha. And sometimes people get into terrible negative states, even depression, simply because they haven't been watching the fuel of their mind. And they've allowed this negative, infected fuel just to flow and flow and flow until it swamps and floods the mind with this terrible blackness. And it makes you a very terrible person to live with. And you can't even stand yourself. That's what's called depression. But there's no need for that. When you understand the fuel source of negativity, just these negative thoughts, you can just stop them. You can just dismiss them. You see some crazy guy coming into the monastery. You say, I'm sorry, we don't speak to crazy guys on Tuesdays. Please come on Thursday. That's when I'm on retreat and Ajahn Jayasaro will be able to deal with them. Whatever it is. Whatever it is, you can find some way. That's only, there's no crazy person came today, you're safe. Whatever it is, you can find ways of dismissing people and getting rid of people. You can find ways of getting rid of these negative thoughts. And even the super positive thoughts. Of the two, the super positive thoughts, at least it gives you a fuel of a bit of happiness. And so they are sort of okay. But you have to be careful about whether it's super positive thoughts about the right things. If it's fuel about karma loka, about sensory thoughts, if you think that when's the next birthday coming up so I can have toast, or if you think just when, there's how many more days of the rains to go so I can go and visit my family and watch some video games or whatever. Remember sort of the sensuous thoughts. Contemplate what happens. You know, when you have karma vitaka, and just how it's really slowing the process of liberation. You should have enough knowledge or faith to know exactly what the Buddha was teaching, and to know there is such a thing as jhanas, there is such a thing as freedom from the sensory world, there is such a thing as stream winning and once returning, non-returning enlightenment. Those are things that exist, they're real. If you want them, this is what you have to do. Sure, it's tough sometimes. If you want to get a degree, you have to work hard for many years. If you leave this monastery and just want to survive, it's tough just getting a job and getting by and living in a little house before you can actually get up and get a bigger house or get a car or something. And it's just not easy. Just life isn't easy. So I don't think this monastery is going to be easy. That you can just hang out here and just think you're going to get somewhere. And if you just hang out and hang out and hang out, after a while the negative states of mind will increase, the unwholesome states will develop, and you find you can't stay. It's not that you get chucked out, it's just, you know, as the Buddha said, if it's a rotten body, the ocean throws it up on the shore. It's just the nature of this Dhamma Vinaya. So it takes some work. But it's not the work of willpower, it's always the work of wisdom power. Investigate, investigate, investigate. Use your mindfulness to understand the processes of your mind, the moods and its causes. And of course, of the two, the positive mood is the better. But even better than the positive mood is the peaceful mood. The mood which is like even. It's happy but even. And to get that even mood, we understand just looking for pleasure in the sensory world, it just agitates the mind. It never gives it the peace, the stillness, the evenness. But the desire to let go, to abandon, to renounce, to disengage from the world, does lead to a feeling of peace, of evenness, of stillness. And the more one disengages, the more stillness one feels. And here one understands that what one is disengaging, while one is disengaging, one is literally cutting off the fuel source of the agitation. You've all meditated enough to have peaceful times, peaceful moments. When those peaceful moments occur, those are great sources of wisdom. You don't need to have jhanas to get a degree of insight and wisdom into peace and its causes, its fuel. So when we're talking about upadana as a fuel, it's not just the fuel of negative states, you look at the fuel of positive states. What causes those? In a sense, it's no fuel at all because it's cutting off the support systems of the gas supply, which creates the agitation, but still it can qualify as a cause of the fuel, if you like. Just this disengaging, this letting go, this renouncing. And as you contemplate with your wisdom faculty more and more, you found the more times I disengage, the more time I stay by myself, and I don't mean just physical solitude, the mental solitude, when I'm aloof, secluded from my past, secluded from my future, secluded from all this thinking and fantasizing and planning and worrying. When I sort of seclude or disengage myself from all of that, there's a great sense of peace, a sense of freedom. And you actually feel like a monk, like a samana. The word for monk in the time of Buddha was samana, which means like an even-minded person. Like sama means like even. In other words, you're not sort of going up and down like a sort of ping-pong ball. You know, sometimes great fun, next time really depressed. You can sit still, because your mind is still and your body is still. That's a samana. You can do that because you learn how to disengage from things. Again, one way of learning how to disengage is actually reflecting. When we chant a sutta like the Adita Pariyaya Sutta, the fire sermon, saying all these things are on fire. It's just not just the six senses, it's just the content of those six senses. And anything felt from those six senses, any happiness or any pain arising from those six senses, it's all on fire. Fire with greed, hatred and delusion. When we understand all of that, you just get this nibbida towards anything to do with the senses. This nibbida leads to this disengagement. So why am I bothered with these things? It's the nature of them. They're on fire. They're hot to the touch. No more than you would put your hand in the stove, in the kitchen. No more would you put your mind or put your interest in this world of the six senses. You disengage. And as you disengage, you do experience the peace. Sometimes that you reflect, why is this? It makes so much sense, but why can't I do this? And it's because the other half of upadana, the fuel source, why do I keep on getting involved in these things, even though I know it's going to hurt? And of course the reason is because the biggest source of fuel is this sense of me, a self, an I. The more you think you exist, the more you will engage. So fuel goes the other way. The experience of the world of happiness and suffering fuels your ego. It builds it up. That's what makes the sense of self, the experience in the world, or even the experience in the mind. That's where the self comes from. So here I'm talking about the fuel which gives rise to the illusion of a self. And it's talking, thinking, playing around in the realm of the five senses makes the illusion which you think you are. Which is why it's such a tough thing to do, to disengage. Because disengaging, if you let go of the objects of the senses and the five senses themselves, sure you get a bit of peace. But the payback of that, the price of that, is that you start to disappear. That yourself has less meaning in the world. There's less things to describe it. Less things to make it a solid entity. You're taking away just the lines which define you. You're vanishing when you disengage. And that's the toughest reason. That's the toughest thing to do. That's the main reason why people find it hard to meditate, why they find it hard to walk the Eightfold Path, why they find it hard to live monastic life. It's the strength of their sense of self. The ego, the me. And that's one of the reasons why we have vinaya, why we have korwat. When you have like the monastic rules, when we have the sort of the ways of doing things, it means we don't have much chance of individuality. Now you can't just make a robe the way you want it. You can't just make your bowl the way that you want it. In fact, those people who do have just slightly different bowls than someone else, you ask, why are you doing that? Why do you want to be different? And you can understand the reason why, because that's what the self wants to do. It wants to stand out, to be an individual, to be different than everybody else. The rules of vinaya just make you the same. We've got the same hairstyle, the same clothes. And sometimes, so when people don't really know you, they can't really tell which one is which. And they come to the monastery and they say, is that monk there? Which one? The bald one? The one in the brown robe? It's a waste of time. Don't know which one it is. Because you all look pretty much the same. And there's a reason for that. To let go of the individuality means you're letting go of the sense of self. You're dying. To be able to die that way, you're cutting off the main source of fuel for samsara. Which is why that, you know, when we have something like the Adita Pariyaya Sutta, the Fire Sermon, or the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, or Non-Self, which we chanted last week, or even the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta. Actually, not the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta. They say, well, those other two suttas, that those monks all were enlightened. Because of anupadaya, asawehi, chitehi, vimuchati, or chanti. They were freed from the outflowings because of no upadana, or upadaya, same word really, through the lack of fuel. This fueling which gave rise to a sense of self, which gave rise to the continuation of the samsaric wheel, was cut off. When they saw that whether in the senses there was nothing there worthy of holding on to, just all aflame. Anything which comes from those senses, just all hurting, painful to the touch like a fire. Any feeling arising from those senses, even the bliss of jhanas, was just like a fire. There's nothing left to really hold on to. There's no support. No gas, no fuel left for a sense of me. When there's no fueling for the sense of a self, the self just dies. There's nothing left. There's nothing left to get reborn. That's how enlightenment happens. The seed is destroyed. Kina jati avivulhi chanda. Kina bija, the seed has been destroyed. Once that seed of the delusion of self is gone, then chanda, the desire which comes from the self, is destroyed. See, this is just what the sense of self does. Its nature is to want, to desire, to move. Because that's why you move, that's why the mind moves. The stronger the sense of self, the stronger your identity, who you think you are, the more the mind will be agitated. Because the sense self does. It's the sense of self which has to disagree. Because in agreeing, it doesn't exist. In disagreeing, in contradicting, in fighting against, then it has an existence. In agreeing, it's just one of a crowd. It merges, it melts, it disappears. It fades. So you can understand where all the argument comes from. You can understand where all the movement comes from this upadana, feeding into a sense of a self, a me, and the self feeding back with a more upadana. Upadana is feeding a thinking mind, a planning mind, which just wants to do things. That's why the types of upadana which we have, karma upadana, just feeds off the five senses. That's why people love to just to play in the world, love to go places, love to do things, love to see movies, love to experience sex. If you only experience one type of sex, more types of sex, strange sex, weird sex, anything. I remember a story which I read many, many years ago. I think it was before I became a monk. I was reading in the story of the partition of India after the British left. And in part of this story they talked about the Maharaja of Kashmir at the time when the British were still in power. And the Maharaja of Kashmir had, when he was only 14 years of age, on his birthday, his father gave him a harem for his birthday. 14 years, you're old enough now. So he supplied him with the rooms and a few girls, and he could actually pick up some more girls as he went on. And so by the time he was like 18, he was just so satiated with ordinary sex, he started getting into weird sex. And he became a scandalous Maharaja of Kashmir with a very straight-laced British Empire. And when I read that, just many, many bells rang that said this is what would happen. And if you start indulging in the senses, after a while the ordinary pleasures don't mean very much anymore. You have to have something more extreme. And more extreme after that. This was talking to one or two monks. It's really amazing in this monastery that when we have toast in the morning, just how exciting that is. And you tell that to people outside. What? You really get excited because you have toast in the morning? We have that every day. If you have it every day, there's nothing to it. You understand how sensory pleasures work? After a while, you just get satiated. It doesn't mean anything anymore. You have to have something even more. French toast or toast with chili powder. I don't know whatever people have on it just to make it sound nice or taste nice. But this is actually, what was it? I remember this Japanese restaurant. The people were getting so satiated that there's one restaurant where they have this bullfrog or something. And it's very, very dangerous to eat. But if you don't do it exactly right, it's poisonous and people die. And I think every now and again, I think about 1 out of 20 people actually die from eating this bullfrog. But it's such a delicacy that people really try. Imagine you're having a meal and you know you've got a 5% chance of dying after this meal. And that's really attractive. A lot of people pay a lot of money for that and have to sign a form saying if they do die, they're not going to sue the restaurant. It's exciting. That's what people do when they're satiated. Sort of take risks like that. And you understand what's actually happening there. And here in this monastery we're going completely opposite direction. To cut the upadana, we have to sort of allow the self to die. We keep the rules of the monastery. Sure, we don't like doing those rules. They'll always be grating against us. I remember this one nun, the American nun, who was at Wat Pa Phong. And she came and confessed to me once. So what did you do which was very wrong? She said, whenever I wanted a drink of water, she's an American nun, so you can understand why she was doing this. Whenever I wanted a drink of water, I'd deliberately stand up and drink it in my hut. No one could see me, but I would stand up as a rebellion. Because in Thailand, when you're drinking, you've got to squat down to have a drink. And it was a stupid thing. What are we doing that for? No one was seeing you, but she thought she had to do something to be herself. And sometimes that's the stupidity of people breaking rules just because of their sense of self. They have to do that to be. They just resist being just like everybody else. That's ego, sense of self. But the rules of discipline are there to wear down that ego, wear down that sense of self. Until you start to disappear, you fade into the background, you're just a monk, a good monk, just one in the line. It's one of the reasons why this is a very helpful monastery for meditation, because there's so many of you. So you can disappear, you can melt away. But as you disappear and melt away because of the vinaya, because of the form, you can still have your own inner world, where you don't melt, where you exist, where you live, where you make up a self. I remember just reading in some of the Nidana Sanyutta, this is about dependent origination, how rebirth happens. I have something which is called the stations of consciousness, the vijnana titti. And this is just because of thinking, because of fantasizing, because of dreaming, we make these worlds. And it's those worlds where our consciousness can find a footing in a previous life. We're inclining to a particular idea, a place where our consciousness and our sense of self thinks it belongs. We actually create our future lives that way. That's why you've got to be very careful with dreaming, fantasizing and planning, because some of those fantasies will come true and you're actually stuck there. Other times you think, oh, that'd be very good. Really? Think about it. As sometimes when ever I used to have these dreams, I'd always say, what next? Okay, and then this will happen, then what next? And then what next? And after a while, obviously you couldn't maintain the dream anymore. Because all dreams, all fantasies, they are fun up to a point. So what happens afterwards that takes the gloss away from the dream and the fantasy. In your dreamlands, you can stop whenever you like. But in real life, you have to pay the consequences. That's the difference. So that be careful of your dreams, your wants, because that can become a reality in a future life. And there's a problem there. So you become a station of consciousness. You're actually creating, you're using fuel. The way the mind is leaning now and inclining now, that is fueling a future rebirth. And that's scary when you understand what the Buddha meant by the stations of consciousness and how they are created by the craving and the upadana, the fuel, to make them your abidings in the future. So instead of doing that, we can disappear so we have no abidings. We don't create houses, abodes for our future existence. We just disengage from all of the six senses and all the objects of the six senses. We disengage from everything. And we're disengaging from the objects of consciousness. The origin of consciousness, the sense of self, also starts to fade. There's a feedback mechanism. As I let go of the stuff out there lets go of me. And I exist as a mirror image of the stuff out there. That's who yourself is. Don't think it's independent of the objects of consciousness. Yourself is a mirror image. And as you let go out there, so the image inside here of who you think you are fades away. And that's a beautiful process to observe. It's fun fading away. Take my word for it. If you don't take my word for it, take the Buddha's word for it. Take the Kuba Ajahn's word for it. The more you fade, the more fun it is. The more free you are. You test this out. You test it more and more in your monastic life. You test it out in your meditation. You test it out with your insight. Fading is freedom. The more solid you are, the more you can get hit and hurt, the more you bruise, the more vaporous you are. Things just pass through you. Pain, disappointment, frustration, they can't stick on you anymore. Because you're not solid enough. Your sense of self, ego, identity is vanishing. That's why when people criticize you, call you an idiot, say you don't know what you're doing. You call yourself a monk, you're just a lazy good for nothing, you probably sleep too much. You probably just think all the time when you're supposed to be meditating, you probably don't meditate at all, spend all your time reading books. Whatever it is, when people criticize you, why do you even bother getting upset? It's only because you have a solid sense of self. There's someone inside to hit. Therefore the punch leaves a bruise, leaves a mark. The more you vanish, the more you fade away. No one can punch you anymore. It's like trying to punch the air. Just the air doesn't bruise, it doesn't leave a mark. Because you've vanished. That's why they always used to have that as the acid test to see how a person was gaining in their wisdom. Just swear at them. Call them an effing idiot or whatever. Do anything to try and upset them and to see whether they would move. And if they did, it was they hadn't disappeared yet. They still had attachments. Upadana was still flowing. Both ways, the sense of self was still there. As you disappear more and more, the objects of senses disappear, you disappear. You can understand the importance of jhanas. The jhanas is 90% of the world. Maybe I'd call it more than that. 99% of the world has disappeared. And so is the knower. 99% of the knowers disappeared as well. And the mirror image, as the world outside disappears, the world inside disappears. And that should give you the clue to understanding the whole pathway of the jhanas. Just the great disappearing act of the citta, of the mind. As the more and more of the experience of vitakka vichara, of pity sukha, of sukha, of upeka, as these disappear, so does the knower disappear. And as the knower begins to disappear, even more is the infinity of space, infinity of consciousness. Infinity of consciousness, I've translated recently, instead of infinity, I think I called it almost like measureless. Understanding that infinity and zero are basically the same, even in maths. It means cannot be bounded. There's no measure anymore. Similar to the experience when the time disappears. In the present moment, infinity of time. Hopefully you've experienced that when you've been meditating. Time has no meaning. There's no measure to it. That only happens when there's no time in the present moment. Same with experiences in arupa states and the immaterial attainments. The objects of the senses, the object of the mind is disappearing. Space is disappearing. And so is the one who knows it. Until space has no more meaning. Consciousness then disappears. And then the one who knows consciousness disappearing starts to fade. And then there's nothing left. You know there's nothing left. That's the third arupa. And then even the one who knows disappears. And you know the one who's disappeared has disappeared. That's neither perception nor non-perception. Depends on which end you look at. There's an object of consciousness, nothing left. That's why it's no perception. There's a subject of consciousness, you perceiving that. That's why it's perception. It's just from which angle you look at, from inside or outside. But it shows you just how the objects of consciousness and consciousness, the subject, how they feed on each other, how there's a mutual support, a mutual upadana. When you understand this, you understand it's not just karma upadana, it's atavad or atta upadana. As somebody was saying the other day, or maybe atavad upadana. Maybe it's an atta upadana there as well. The sense of self, feeding the objects, creating these stations of consciousness, places where you hang out, things which you do, experiences which not only you play with, but also which feed back on your sense of self, of who you think you are. Creating the world and creating a self, and the two feeding on each other. And here, that feedback mechanism is cut off. First with sila, and then with beautiful sense restraint, where we just stop and say no. We dismiss, just like a good monk dismisses the guests after the meal, without them feeling upset. So you can have a lot of freedom, a lot of space. Sense restraint. And then afterwards, just the world disappears more and more. Jhanas happen. So those of you who are aiming for these jhanas, remember, you have to disappear. Stop trying, stop doing it, stop making a bigger self from the practice of meditation. Disengage from the process. If the objects aren't fading, and there's all these thoughts going on, and this agitation going on in the mind, if the objects aren't fading away, then how about the one who knows? See if you can get that to fade away. It's a much better place to put the effort. Too often people make mistakes in meditation because they look at the object, the breath. Look at loving kindness, this person, that person. They look at everything except from where it's coming from. And they wonder why they can't meditate. I'm watching the breath, but it won't get peaceful. Yeah, because you're agitating it. No, I want it to be peaceful. That's agitating it. Or they get nimittas, and they want the nimitta to be stable. They want it to be still, and it just won't be. It's because you are agitating it. It's not the noise disturbs you. You disturb the noise. It's actually both. Ajahn Chah was only half right there, but he made a good point because it's a point everyone missed. The noise fed into the mind, awakened the mind, made it bigger, made it stronger, gave it a sense of self. That's how the noise disturbed you and how you wanted it to disturb you, to give you a sense of being. That's why people are always listening. What did he say? Why did he say it? Have a conversation, might be having a conversation with somebody in the Dharamsala. None of your business, but you like to listen anyway. Why? Because the sound feeds the sense of self. And the sense of self feeds the sound. That's why you disturb the sound. The upadana going both ways. From the knower doer, the sense of self, out into the world, and from the world back inside of you. So you don't have to really be so concerned about this process, because your conditioning, being in a monastery such as this, the whole flow and current in this monastery is driving you onto the rocks of cessation. Sure, you can try and sort of swim against that current, And you can go around in circles and think you're getting nowhere. But there's a current, an underlying force of the Dhamma in a monastery such as this. Little by little, your sense of self will start to get less and less. You'll start to become one of these monks who just goes back to their huts, stays most of the time by themselves, hardly says a word. Someone who's fading, fading, fading. And you look at those monks who have faded more, those ones who've been here longer, you think, wow, they're just so peaceful, so happy. That gives you the encouragement. The forest monk, they fade away into the forests, into trees, quiet places where no one sees them. A forest is not just the trees. You just disappear, even from your fellow monks, so no one sees you. They can hardly hear you. You're not in contact with the world anymore. You're disengaged. You're disengaged from sights, from sounds, smells, tastes and touches, and even mind objects. People come into the Dhanasala, you don't even look at them. Why should I? Nothing there for me. Food, you put it in your bowl, put it in your mouth, forget about it. Sounds, who cares? You're disengaging, and with it, you disappear. Your friends, you disengage, you disappear. Even your family, disengage, disappear. Till everything goes, vanishes. Till you vanish. What do you mean? I'm a son, I'm a sister, a brother? What does that mean? You look at it very deeply, it's just another hook to make a sense of identity. Another place, another branch for a chicken to roost at night. We cut off all those branches, there's no place left to roost. That's when one is free. All the prisons have been destroyed. This is what we mean by upadana, the fuel source. What the self takes up to make its solidity. And what the world takes up to make the self. Both of them are destroyed. That's what it means by anupadaya. Through no fuel, through no self left, through no contact between the two, the self just withers and dies. There's no reason to be reborn anymore, because there's no solid entity left. Sure, we all say there's no one in there anyway. What they're actually saying, there's no essence in there, but you've made a self. Over many, many lifetimes, there is an entity there, which sure, it's got no core to it, but it's still there, and it will drive you. It will drive you from day to day, from moment to moment. But as you go deeper into that, allow it to disappear, then you can see because there was nothing essentially there, it can just unpeel like an onion until there's nothing left. And that is freedom. That is the end of suffering. And you can maybe understand why we do have things like Sila Samadhi Panya. And why when some people say, do you need jhana to get enlightened? Of course you need jhana to get enlightened. This is just a fading away. It's just a stage in the process. It's just part of the path, a signpost of where things are gone. Of how much you've disappeared. The more you disappear, the easier these attainments become. The more solid you are, the more you suffer. The more you engage in the world, the more you disappear, the more the world disappears. When the two of you disappear together, that's called Nibbana. So may you all disappear as soon as you possibly can. Because for the next 2 weeks, I am going to disappear into my cave on retreat. The next talk will be in 3 weeks' time. Satipano
Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Sangha.